right now. This is intense stuff. It's never particularly fun to remember our darker moments, but trust me when I tell you that allowing yourself to go back to that time and feel all those feelings can be an incredibly powerful tool for a salesperson. Tell me, what does that moment look like? Describe the scene. What do you see? What are you feeling? Were you scared, hurt, embarrassed, terrified, or totally humiliated? Maybe a hideous cocktail of all of the aforementioned feelings? I know it sucks to remember, but if you can, take all those feelings and channel them into a fierce desire to move yourself to a better and brighter place. Every time a little voice in your head says, "Wow, this is hard. I'm not doing so great this week," stop right there. Don't dwell on difficult times, but the simple act of reminding yourself that at this moment, your back is not against that wall is an amazing feeling. You've distanced yourself from it, and that will give you the energy to keep going. My wall. Years ago, it was having my credit card declined at a New York City grocery store. Now, wasted potential is what scares me. Your wall. What is that moment, or day, or mental state you need to distance yourself from forever? I'm asking for very heavy answers. Maybe your last job had you crying at the end of each day. Is that what you're running from? Were you in a bad relationship and now you're on your own and don't want to look back? Go ahead and describe it in all its grisly detail. Pause this recording and write about how you can distance yourself as far as possible from that moment. Tenet number 4, the win. What are you doing this for? I would like to leave a very big impact on the world. It's not just about selling and earning a large income, although those things are enjoyable. It's about what you're known for when you die. Back to that taxi, the one I hope that does not run me over tomorrow. If it did, and the life of Ryan Serhant came to an abrupt end on the corner of Broadway and Houston Street, I'd probably be remembered as that guy who was on that reality TV show about selling high-end real estate in New York. That would be okay. I've been incredibly fortunate to be on TV. But I'd like my legacy to be bigger. I'd love to be remembered as the person who changed the way sales is viewed as a profession. It would be awesome if I inspired salespeople to take pride in their work, and I was able to encourage people to fully embrace a job that can be so rewarding if you just work for it. How cool would it be if sales was viewed as a super exciting profession that people couldn't wait to break into? Who cares about glossy fashion magazine writing jobs? Sales is the place for me. If I could play even a small part in making that happen, that would be a major win. Before I encourage you to think about your win, I want to make it clear that a win is not a reward. A car is a reward. Buying a new suit or a piece of jewelry is a reward. Those are not wins. Rewards are something you buy yourself because you are either gifting or incentivizing yourself. It's perfectly acceptable to give yourself a reward. A win is something bigger. A win is the legacy you leave behind. And your win doesn't have to be as big as change the world, but it needs to be real. It needs to change you. And it needs to be something you really want. Are you a struggling mother of two, and you aspire to provide well for your kids and maybe even pay for their college education in full to set them up on the right path? So when they come home in their early 30s, they can afford to take care of you? That's a win. Ask yourself, what's the conversation you'd like people to have about you when you're not around? Be honest, what would you like people to say? That you were an awesome sales machine? That you had a great tax return one year? That you inspired your team and you achieved great things together? That you came up with the most creative pitches and always had a fresh approach to selling? That you connected so effortlessly with customers? Think big! What is the legacy you'd like to leave behind? What kind of mark do you want to make on the world? And don't say you can't think that big. You're human. You have a brain, and you're listening to a book about how to be a better salesperson so you can make more money and lead a more fulfilling life. Think big. Ask yourself, what's your win? My win? Changing the way people view sales so that everyone in the world will want to work in a job that offers limitless possibilities. Your win? What do you want people to say about you when you're not in the room? Pause this recording and write down what's the big mark you want to leave on the world. Don't hold back. After my dad blew my mind, my attitude shifted. It wasn't just a way to work harder. This was about building a career I could be proud of. My mindset shifted from, this is what I need to do to sell, get up early and work a ton of hours, to, this is what I'm going to do to build an amazing career. My career wasn't all about earning money, although that certainly was part of the equation. I was pushing myself to think about what I could do to be the best salesperson I could be. The four tenets are the building blocks that get me to the next level. Positivity, the oil that keeps everything running. I've known what my four tenets are for a long time, but there have still been moments in my career where I felt beyond challenged, and staying positive, along with the support of my wife, are the only things that keep it all from falling apart. Positivity can seriously save your ass. 5 years ago, I pitched my heart out to the Colonnade Group, who had a building I wanted to sell. I kept refreshing my email like a freak, hoping to get an email saying I'd gotten the job. When I found out they were going with someone else, I was devastated. Fast forward 4 years, and they call me. The penthouse still hasn't sold. We're asking $7 million. Would you like to try to sell it? Yes, I would. I throw myself into the work. I stage the apartment. It looks amazing. And market the hell out of it. I'm thrilled this listing has come back to me full circle. And it will sell. Month one goes by with no offers. Month two, three, and four... zero offers. Now I'm getting nervous. My exclusive agreement is about to expire, and I get the dreaded phone call that they'll be using someone else. Most brokers would have thought, that's fine. It's not selling. I'll let it go. Most brokers would have had an excuse. It's the market. It's too hot outside. Mercury is in retrograde. But not me. Deep in my core, I believed I could sell this apartment. I was positive I could. Ready, set, go. I called everyone. I spent the entire day emailing and calling people trying to find a buyer. I never stopped believing I could pull this off, and it worked. I found one. After 2 weeks of negotiations, contracts were signed. Sold! To celebrate, I popped by the apartment and jumped on top of the counter. I made sure my shoes were clean first. To take a picture for Instagram so I could shout about the sale to the world. Follow-up, perseverance, and hard work matter. But sometimes a deal is so challenging that your positivity is the only thing that can get you through. When it looked like I was going to lose the listing again, I didn't waste an ounce of energy on fear or doubt. I shifted everything into high gear, staying positive until we had a signed contract. Be positive. Ignore all the reasons it seems like something can't be done. Focus on what you can do right now to get the deal done. When it feels like nothing is working, your positivity can give you just the boost you need to work a little harder, make one more phone call, reach out to one more person, or try just one more thing. And suddenly, when it feels like all is lost, you've closed your deal. I really don't know anything about jazz, but I do know that a famous trumpeter named Roy Hargrove, who skyrocketed to the top of his game at a young age, said something very wise that I'll always remember. He said, if you're going to be a musician, you've got to be open. Don't leave anything out. If you take care of the music, it will take care of you. I love this quote, because what Hargrove expressed so beautifully about his music is exactly how I feel about my work as a salesperson. If I take care of the work will take care of me. Think about it. Life is gonna go up and down. You will have great days and some you'd like to forget ever happened. You will have good relationships and bad ones. It's all inevitable. But if you stay positive, stay thankful, and you take care of the work will take care of you. But first, you must truly understand what your work entails. For Hargrove, his work is changing the face of music one song at a time, and it gets him through the shit. Please, before you move on to the next chapter, pound out your four tenets and let your work take care of you. The Serhant Way. If you do anything at all from this book, please take the time to think about your four tenets and write down your thoughts. I draw strength from mine regularly, and I'm not kidding when I say that doing this can change your life. It was revolutionary for me to truly understand the difference between working for the job and working for the career. Knowing my why and my when reminds me why all this hard work and effort matter. And remembering my wall makes me feel gratitude about where I am in life today, but also makes it much easier to get out of bed and get to work in the morning. I couldn't afford yogurt. I also make a point of revisiting my tenets because reminding myself why I do all this keeps me centered, focused, and inspired to work harder and achieve more. And don't forget that your answers might change over time. And that's fine. Make revisiting and refining your tenets a regular part of your sales practice. Tenet number one, the why. Why do you do what you do? Tenet number two, the work. What do you do every day to expand your business? Tenet number three, your wall. What are you running from? Tenet number four, the win. What are you doing this all for? Positivity. Don't underestimate the power of positivity. It's the oil that keeps it all running smoothly. Chapter 8. Be the One Who. A Tale of Two Brownstones. I once listed two brownstones for sale on the same block, at the same time, for about $10 million each. These balls were very similar, but had some interesting differences. The first listing, on West 87th Street, was the best of brownstones. It was as if 1884 and 2017 had had a baby, and that baby was awesome. It had been meticulously restored by an amazing developer. It had original fireplaces, rococo ceilings, and mahogany wood as far as the eye could see. It also had a beautiful modern kitchen, 8 perfect bathrooms, a massive roof deck with outdoor heating, and an elevator so you could ride up and down, stopping to admire each floor of your ridiculously cool house. I wouldn't say the second listing was the worst of brownstones. It had all the charming old details that people expect from a brownstone on the Upper West Side, like pocket doors and high ceilings, original crown moldings, and the parlor for drinking tea and smoking cigars while wearing slippers. But unlike its better-appointed neighbor just down the block, it wasn't staged. There was no furniture at all. It didn't have an elevator or a roof deck. Selling an empty house that looked sad and abandoned would normally be almost impossible. Except it wasn't, because it was Billie Holiday's house. No roof deck? Who cares? You could tell people that Lady Day had swinging cocktail parties in your house with lots of famous jazz musicians. I mean, whoever had originally lived at the better brownstone was probably just a normal, non-famous, musically challenged pedestrian like the rest of us. Whoever bought Billie Holiday's house wasn't just buying a home. She was also buying a unique piece of history. And that history never changes. The next buyer and the buyer after that all get to say things like, Do you agree that Billie Holiday's rendition of George Gershwin's Summertime is unparalleled? Am I right? Oh, did I mention this was Billie Holiday's house? That is a cool story. And it's the kind of story that sells a house, even one that's empty. I never forget that I'm not really selling a product. I'm selling a product story. Obviously, not every house I sell was once inhabited by a legendary jazz singer, but a home is a great big ball of emotion. It's not an ordinary purchase. It's the place where you'll relax and catch up on Game of Thrones after a long day, and where your future children will trip over furniture while learning to walk. But nearly every purchase we make is tied to a feeling. The shoes we choose to buy send signals about who we are, like, whoa, he's fancy, or those are sensible clogs. You must be a nurse or a lunch lady or Mario Batali. People want to feel good about what they've purchased. You want to be able to tell your friends you got a great deal on your car, or you just bought the same kind of golf clubs that Rory McIlroy uses. Or maybe that your wedding dress was made by the same designer who made Kate Middleton's third cousin's wedding gown. You can create that essential connection between the product and the customer by relaying a story. At the end of the day, that's ultimately all anyone wants, a good bedtime story. Crafting that story isn't always as simple as saying, you know who loves these socks? George Clooney. More often, you have to get creative and dig deep, learning as much as you can about your product to find that little seed of a story. Because a good story is exciting. And when you sell excitement, you can sell anything. Even an empty, sad, old house. Sirhan's secret number 16. Go beyond the facts. When selling any product, sell it with a story. You'll close more deals and quickly. Every product has a story. You just have to find it. Meet John Decco. When I was 25, I became one of New York City's youngest sales directors of a building, 99 John Street. I was incredibly excited and insanely nervous. It was 442 apartments, nearly a $500 million sellout, and a lot of pressure. And I had never done anything like that before. This was a huge opportunity, but only if I could figure out how to actually sell the apartments. This was a short time after the financial markets collapsed in 2008. And the homes weren't selling, which is how I got the project in the first place. The developer had an on-site sales team that had sold almost nothing, and they needed someone hungry who was going to create the market. Brokers had written the building off. No one was even coming to see it. I needed to find a way to put a fresh spin on this building so I could get some traffic going. I decided to start by learning as much about the building as I could. When I Googled it, lots of information came up about the 442 units being developed into condos. Nothing interesting about that. When the market is great, that's all you need. When the market is bad, you need to sell more than just the product. You need to sell the story. I wanted to find that special nugget of information that would make people get excited about coming to see it. Like George Washington once stayed here, or Justin Bieber. Then I found it. I discovered that 99 John Street was designed by Shreve, Lamb, and Harmon. What? Who are they? Oh, you know, just the architects who designed a little Art Deco marvel known as the Empire State Building. These architects were big names in the Art Deco movement of New York City. The Art Deco movement is associated with beautiful architecture, glamour, cocktails, and people enjoying cigarettes because they didn't yet know that smoking was going to kill them. The Art Deco roots of 99 John Street were unique and gave me something to work with. I called my friend from college, Tom Booth, who is a talented illustrator. He created a silhouette of a man with a cool Humphrey Bogart-style hat, and we named him John Decco. John Decco became the basis of our marketing campaign. We decided to throw John Decco a homecoming party as our launch event. We invited a lot of brokers for food and drinks and gave out fancy gifts from Tiffany's and Hermes, making sure everyone knew that both of those stores were located right in the area. See what a great neighborhood this is? Now people were talking about the building. Suddenly, instead of calling the building 99 John, brokers started referring to it as the John Deco building. It was no longer just a bunch of units being converted into condos. Now everyone knew about the building's rich history because we had created a story to showcase it to potential buyers. We got our first three offers the next day. Using a story to craft a creative pitch. Step one, clearly define your challenge. My problem was that no one was paying attention to this building anymore. It was a tough market and it didn't stand out. It was essentially just another building being converted into condos. I needed to find a fresh way to get people talking about it. Step two, dig in. Go beyond the basic facts about your product. What is the history of your product and can you use it to tell an interesting story for a fresh pitch? 99 John was built by a legendary architectural firm who had built some of New York City's most prized architectural gems. This is an interesting piece of history unique to 99 John Street. Do you sell hand lotion? Who invented hand lotion and why? How far has hand lotion technology come? Did you know Native Americans used to moisturize with boiled down animal fat? Isn't this a great time to be alive? Our 2-for-1 product has no animal fat. Have 4 bottles. Step 3. Plant the seed. How can you use this story in a creative way to make people want the product? I was able to use the fact that the building was a great example of Art Deco architecture to make it stand out from other, more generic developments. We used the history to create the image of John Deco, who became the basis for our fresh new marketing campaign. We had an interesting story to share with buyers. Sell insurance? Having a hard time convincing people they need insurance? Here's a seed. Did you know that insurance dates back to the dawn of humanity, when neighbors would insure each other with a place to live should something happen to their homes? Survival of the fittest with the insurance of the buddy system. Now, I know you probably don't want your wife moving in with Ted next door should your house collapse on top of you, making her a widow. Isn't it a great time to be alive? The premium on our life insurance is 25% off today only. Product knowledge equals power. I met Frank when he asked for my help selling kitchen cabinets, and we decided to film his story for Sell It Like Sirhan. Frank was a real character. He was like something out of a Bronx tale. He was super easy to talk to, but for some reason he couldn't close a deal. He was great at connecting with customers, but when they started to ask questions, he'd often step away and ask a colleague to come help. As a starting point, I wanted Frank to tell me a little about his product. When I asked him what the cabinets were made out of, he shrugged and said, wood? Okay. It quickly became clear that Frank didn't know anything about his product, other than that cabinets were things you put in kitchens to store boxes of cereal. Until Frank had better product knowledge, he wouldn't be confident answering any questions. And who wants to buy their kitchen from that guy? People want to spend their money with the most confident and most knowledgeable person. Otherwise, they'll just stay at home and shop on the internet. And right now, Frank was not beating the internet. Sirhan's secret number 17. If you want to learn how to sell a meal, you've got to spend some time in the kitchen. If it's possible to see how your product is produced firsthand, do it. We took a road trip to Pennsylvania, where Frank's company got the lumber for their cabinets. We watched as giant trees were taken down and cut into planks, and they let me hold a chainsaw. Then the wood was dried in a special process that could take up to 2 years. The cabinets were carefully handcrafted by actual human beings. These were some seriously next-level cabinets. Now Frank can answer questions about his product with more than a one-word response. Wood. And his newfound knowledge about the intricacies of cabinet making provided a good starting point for a story. He could talk to customers about the quality of their product, how the cabinets are custom made from hand-cut, cured wood, and that his company had been making cabinets this way since the 1950s. These weren't cheap cabinets you'd have to put together yourself, puzzling over vague instructions for hours, only to end up with a crooked kitchen that gives your house a condemned look. These cabinets were the best. They were designed to house your family's Cocoa Puffs and Yodels for generations to come. Frank's newfound product knowledge enabled him to craft a compelling pitch. These cabinets are hand-built from solid hardwood, unlike most cabinets made of less durable pine, using traditional, old-world techniques. These cabinets are one of the best investments you can make in your home, as they are built to last your family a lifetime. We've been installing them in beautiful kitchens around New York City for over 50 years. Sold! Using the product to craft a creative pitch. Step 1. Clearly define your challenge. Frank's challenge was that there are now countless places to buy kitchen cabinets. Big box stores, the internet, and to complicate things further, his cabinets, while worth every penny, were a larger investment than some of the other options out there. How could he clearly show customers the true value of his product? Step 2. Dig in. On our road trip, Frank learned firsthand why his product requires a larger investment than his competitors. His product was handmade in America in a detailed process that's taken several generations to perfect. He wasn't selling cheap crap. He was selling the Rolls Royce of cabinets. But now that Frank had seen the care and craftsmanship that went into building his product, he could use this knowledge when talking to customers. He now understood these weren't ordinary kitchen cabinets. Step 3. Plant the seed. Now Frank could build a story and pitch around the fact that he's seen how his product is built by skilled human beings and knows that it's a superior option and the cabinets will last a lifetime. He can use this information to create a story that will appeal to a homeowner's emotions. That these cabinets had been carefully crafted using the same old-school techniques for over 50 years. Using creativity to craft a story or pitch is a really fun process, and I've used it countless times. Enjoy being creative. It will help you attract shiny new balls, get publicity, and close deals. Once, I hired an artist to paint the naked bodies of models and then made a 100-foot-long banner out of the images and hung it on the building I was selling to create buzz. It worked. People talked about it, and the building sold. We weren't just another boring new condo project. Once I was selling an apartment with zero views. It literally faced a brick wall. This apartment was ideal for someone who didn't care about light, like maybe a vampire. I staged a glow-in-the-dark party to show how perfect this apartment was for people who were only home late at night. And it worked. It sold. I embraced the totally dated 1980s decor in a townhouse by throwing an 80s party and arriving in a DeLorean. It sold in one day for $7.5 million. There are no limits to how you can use creativity to highlight what is interesting or unique about a product so that people will still want to buy it. The one who. Every salesperson needs a hook. Anthony Hopkins is a well-respected actor who has played Richard Nixon and C.S. Lewis. Very serious roles. But when you see Sir Anthony Hopkins, commander of the Order of the British Empire, on the screen, the first thing you probably think is, wow, that guy he's standing next to better watch out because Hopkins is probably going to eat his face. When we see Anthony Hopkins, we don't say, he's the one who played the butler in that stunning Merchant Ivory picture. We say, that's the serial killer who ate people's livers with a side of fava beans and a nice glass of Chianti. Hopkins is known as the one who played Hannibal Lecter. I started out as the one who asked pregnant women at Starbucks if they needed more space. And while there is an abundance of pregnant women in New York City, I knew that if I wanted to be successful, I'd have to expand beyond being the one who found new apartments for families looking to upgrade. I was not going to be satisfied with the success that came along with renting two-bedroom apartments. I wanted the kind of success that came from selling multi-million dollar apartments every day. In sales, there is a direct correlation between the business that you get and the business you're known for. So how do you make the shift from the person you are now, the person who sells a little, to the person you want to be, the one who sells a lot all the time? The decision I made to become a broker who sells 7- and 8-figure apartments took time. A lot of time. But I followed a few core ideas to become the one who sells multi-million dollar apartments. Establish your base camp. Create a hook and get ready to climb. Your first hook as a salesperson is that special thing about you. It's what makes someone want to buy from you rather than anyone else. When Frank and I got back from our road trip to Pennsylvania, we worked on what made him the best person to buy cabinets from. Frank decided his hook was that he was the soup-to-nuts kitchen guy. He was the guy who vowed to work with customers until their dream kitchen was finished. He'd guide them throughout the entire process, from picking out the cabinets to measurements and installation, right up until the moment when those cabinets were filled with coffee cups. He wasn't going to sell you some cabinets and then ditch you to figure the rest out on your own. Frank's thing was that he stuck around. Who you are as a salesperson today may not be who you are tomorrow or next year. Sure, for now, Frank is the soup-to-nuts kitchen guy, and that's great. But should Frank be hanging out at a neighborhood barbecue when he's introduced to Joe, the guy who owns 50 apartment buildings? Then Frank should become the one who arranges for high-quality kitchen cabinets to be installed in large apartment buildings. His sales would instantly increase. Becoming the best salesperson means having a hook, but also being flexible and open to playing with different kinds of balls. In a million years, I would have never imagined I'd be known as the one who breaks real estate records in Brooklyn. Selling real estate in Brooklyn has become a huge part of my business. And had I not been willing to change from being the one who sells apartments in Manhattan to the guy who also sells them in Brooklyn, I would have missed out on a massive opportunity for myself and my team. Your original hook is your starting point. But don't be afraid to change it. As the wind blows, you go. Shout it from the mountaintop. Success begets success. As I was transitioning from the one who rents two bedrooms to expectant parents, I shouted to the entire world about any big deal I made. Sure, for a long time, the bulk of my deals were rentals, with an occasional sale sprinkled in here and there. But I did not wait until I got to where I am today to shout about being the billion-dollar broker. That would have made zero sense. If you make a big sale, you're one step closer to being the salesperson you want to be. Let everyone know about it. Send out postcards, post on social media, talk about it every chance you get. No one else but yourself, or maybe your mother, is going to shout about your accomplishments. Once I decided to be a real estate agent, I knew I wanted to be the one who sells multi-million dollar apartments. But I didn't wake up one day and say, well, I've had it with $2,000 per month rentals. I know, I'll just stalk people on Park Avenue until someone agrees to let me sell their $20 million penthouse today. While it would have been fun to try, chances are it would have resulted in a restraining order. I was nailing the $2,000 per month apartments. So instead of looking for more of that business, I actively searched for people I could rent $3,000 apartments to, and then $4,000. I wasn't making giant career leaps. That's a futile effort. I was taking baby steps. The conversation with the customer who buys a $3,000 hot tub is very similar to the one who buys a $4,000 one. Same amount of work, knowledge, time, and effort, but you make more money slowly. Then $4,000 becomes $5,000, and so on until you only get out of bed for that Mac Daddy $15,000 hot tub daydream. In sales, success begets success. Now that I was renting to people who had larger budgets, they were referring their friends to me who had equally large or even larger budgets. Then one day, one of those customers saw that it would be cheaper per month to own than to rent. And just like that, I now only worked in sales. Even to this day, I'm always thinking about what ball I can reach for next. What business am I not doing right now that I should be doing? Cast yourself as the one who does bigger and better things that you could never have imagined and do them. Embrace longevity. Enjoy the view from the top. While I embrace growth, expansion in all ways, please, I always acknowledge that for a salesperson, ultimately being known for one big thing is great. It means you've made it to the top. Being typecast as an actor isn't ideal. Can you even imagine what would happen if Will Ferrell played Hannibal in Hannibal Lecter Part 4, The Final Meal? He could do a scene where he eats someone's appendix, and we'd all think it was hilarious. Will Ferrell is one of the funniest human beings alive, and it would be hard for us to view him as a deranged cannibal. But if you've reached a level where you're typecast for what you sell, and you're happy with it, it's a great thing. You sell diamonds but only above 3 carats? Awesome! You're the woman who sells huge diamonds. You sell outdoor movie theaters, but they start at 6 figures and you work with a landscaper to have them installed on estates in the Hamptons? Great! You're the one who sells insane outdoor cinemas. Once you're happy about what and who you're selling to, embrace it and enjoy it and be ready to move with the wind. When you're at work, you are at work. I need to be very clear about something. When you are at work, you need to act like you're at work. The store is open, you are open. Thousands of struggling salespeople reached out to me about coming on my show, Sell It Like Sirhan. Ultimately, 8 people made it onto the first season. Each one of these salespeople was in danger of losing his or her job, and all of them had different challenges to conquer. Some people, like Frank, had 0 product knowledge, while others struggled to make personal connections with potential customers. But there was one common thread I saw across the board that drove me bananas. Unless they were face-to-face directly with a customer, they weren't on. And when a salesperson is at work, you are at work. You're not eating a bagel or scrolling through your ex's Instagram. You are on and ready to make a sale. On the first day of filming each episode, I would walk into the store to observe the salesperson I'd be working with. I made sure they didn't know I was coming. I'm sneaky. Every single time I saw the same thing. The salesperson was sitting and waiting, shoulders hunched over, no smile in sight. Worse than that, half the people I worked with were in a corner somewhere on their phone. They weren't interacting with clients or even saying something simple like, "Hello, beautiful day," or, "Hey, we have this amazing new lavender body scrub in. You've got to smell it." You can't wait for the perfect opportunity to arise to initiate a connection or start selling. That's not how you build a sales career. Remember dial-up internet? Cue AOL's "You've got mail" notification. These days, the internet is always on, and it has changed the world. Information, connection, a new sweater, and your favorite song are always at your fingertips. That's how salespeople need to be. If your inner salesperson is always on, you can change the world. You are always prepared, ready to go. You don't wait for a customer to appear in front of you before you flip a switch and are open for business. Successful salespeople are always on. I'm not saying you should stand on the street 12 hours a day with a freaky smile and demand that people buy donuts from you. I'm saying just because a customer is not in front of your face, that does not give you a ticket to do nothing. If you learn anything from this book, it's that there is so much to do when the customer isn't there to build your sales numbers. In fact, when you're alone is the best time to be a salesperson. We can prospect for new clients for 30 minutes, send follow-up, follow-through, and follow-back emails and texts for another 30 minutes, and strategize with our manager on an incentive of the day to offer to customers if they buy today. Trolling Facebook for an hour is only okay if you are finding clients. Sirhan's secret number 18. No customers in front of you? This is an excellent opportunity to get work done. Let your inner freak flag fly and have fun. You never know what you're going to find when a client opens the door. As a broker, I've walked into rooms and found giant piles of creepy doll heads and sculptures made out of garbage. Once, I was talking to a Wall Street trader about what he wanted in a new apartment when a kangaroo bounced out of his bedroom and hopped across his loft. Brokers see weird things, but I was still surprised when Patty, this tiny Chinese grandmother, opened the large closet in her spare bedroom. From floor to ceiling, it was packed full of ribbons, bows, and lace in every imaginable color. It was like Hello Kitty and Snow White got high together and decided to open an Etsy shop. This little lady, who negotiated like a seasoned Wall Street ballbuster, by the way, had a passion for making hair bows. I closed the door and hoped potential buyers wouldn't be turned off by Patty's psychedelic ribbon cave. I was lucky. I was able to sell Patty's apartment at full asking price in less than a day. But there was a catch. The buyer wanted Patty and her ribbons out within 30 days. That meant if I didn't want to lose the sale, I'd have to find Patty an apartment immediately. But Patty hated everything I showed her. One apartment was too cramped. One was too close to the building next door. And she hated one so much that she turned around and left without even walking inside. I was starting to worry I'd lose the buyer we had for Patty's apartment, and my two sales would turn into zero sales. I had to do everything in my power to urge Patty out of the disappointment stage, and fast. I found a listing in Battery Park City that I thought was perfect. But with the days ticking by, I wasn't going to take any chances. I had to make Patty fall in love with this apartment, and her hobby gave me an idea. I wanted to sell Patty on the apartment by showing her she could have an entire room devoted to her bow-making passion. I bought ribbons, a lot of ribbons. I arrived at the apartment early and set up a table in one of the bedrooms. I filled it with baskets of ribbon in every size and color. Patty could make bows for every princess-loving child in America and have enough left over to make awards for ponies and Russian gymnasts. I felt hopeful when Patty walked into the apartment and didn't say she hated anything. She thought the living room was a good size and felt the building next door was far enough away so that no one could spy on her. When I opened the door to the secret ribbon room, Patty's eyes got as wide as saucers, and I knew she was going to buy it. She didn't even flinch when I put a bow on my head and told her the price was final and there would be no negotiating whatsoever. Patty had found her bow-topia, and I was making a double commission. It was a blue ribbon day all around. What's the icing on the cake? Setting up a miniature ribbon factory for Patty was creative, and it worked. There was no way I could have known this at the time, but oddly enough, the first flicker that creativity could be used to increase my sales happened at that strip club with Sarah. Seeing Sarah's admiration for and appreciation of the dancers showed me something interesting about who she was as a person and where she was in her life. And paying attention to this was almost like receiving a map that guided me to the perfect apartment for Sarah. While I couldn't find Patty an apartment above a ribbon shop, yes, I looked. I could make use of these careful observations to help her see that this apartment was perfect for her in every way. Patty did not have Ribbon Cave listed on her wish list for her perfect home, but I could see she valued her time crafting. It was meaningful to her. The ribbons were the icing on top of the cake that was the right size 3-bedroom apartment with perfect light in a great neighborhood. It was the ribbons that made the cake irresistible to Patty. Since making deals for Sarah and Patty, I'm always on the lookout for creative things I can do to get people comfortable with the purchase they are about to make. If your client is stuck in one of the trickier stages of the sale and you need to urge them forward, dig deep. Is there something she might want that extends beyond the typical? For example, if I have a client who loves to cook and is afraid to commit to an apartment, I might bring her fresh produce from the local farmer's market to show her an added benefit to taking the home. Always be thinking about extra incentives you can offer, no matter how small they may be. Chances are your jewelry store won't let you discount a diamond, but maybe you can offer free cleanings for life. You can guarantee to your clients that their diamonds will never stop sparkling. If you sell dollhouses, throw in a miniature kitchen. Sometimes an added incentive isn't just about the object or service itself. It's about how it makes your client feel about their purchase. Here's an example. It's a gray, cold, rainy Saturday afternoon in New York City. For most people, a day like today is ideal for watching Netflix and taking naps. But I put on a coat and head to an open house in Chelsea. There's a new apartment on the market that some of my clients might like, but that's not the only reason I'm choosing to venture out into the rain instead of snuggling with Amelia at home. I know that channeling my creativity and staying open to trying new things are critical parts of my success. The great thing about creativity is that it has zero limits. It's impossible to tap the bottom of your creativity, and it's impossible to think of everything. There's always another angle, another way, a fresh approach. There's always something else that provides new inspiration. And that's why I'm about to walk into a 2-bedroom in Chelsea soaking wet. I want to see how other people sell. I want to know how other brokers do it. I step into a spacious foyer and instantly smell freshly brewed coffee. And wait, are those warm cookies? It's not uncommon to find snacks at an open house, but the combo of good coffee and chocolate chip cookies with soft music playing in the background on one of the grossest days ever immediately gives off a cozy feeling that screams, "You are home." Suddenly, I can see myself coming home to a place like this. I can imagine where I'd put my umbrella and where I'd sit to check my emails and eat dinner with my wife. And I don't even need an apartment. I already have one. The homey feeling the broker has created is distracting everyone from the fact that while the apartment has giant windows in the living room, there's nothing to see outside of them but gray and some more gray. I leave my contact information on the sign-in sheet, and about an hour later, I receive the most comprehensive follow-up email in the history of follow-up emails. The broker didn't just text or email a simple, "Hey, thanks for stopping by." She had carefully thought about any question one of my clients might have about the building, the apartments, and the neighborhood. There were links for everything. She had just made my job so much easier, and I appreciated that. I wrote her back and told her I didn't have a client for the apartment, but I had a spot for her on my team. At home that night, I start to think about how I use creativity in my career. I always use creativity to showcase a product and develop pitches and marketing campaigns. But how can I stretch to use my creativity to grow as a salesperson? What can I do that's new and unusual? How can I use creativity to expand my audience and my network? I am so fortunate to be in front of 2 TV cameras, but maybe it's time for something else. I take a look at my Facebook page, and as I scroll through, I see updates and links and an occasional video. I get out my notebook and open it to my to-do list for the week. I add to my list, start a vlog. Then I add another line, write a sales book. The Serhant Way. Don't be afraid to inject creativity and fun into your pitches. Using creativity and stories to sell your product is an excellent tool that will give you a unique edge over your competition. Crafting a creative pitch. 3 easy steps. 1. Identify the challenge. 2. Dig in. What's the history of your product? Or how is your product produced? 3. Plant the seed. Grow the nugget of information into a pitch. Be the one who. Every salesperson needs a hook. 1. Establish your base camp. Create a hook and get ready to climb. 2. Go with the wind. Be flexible. 3. Shout it from the mountaintop. 4. Climb higher. Don't look for the business you already have. 5. Embrace longevity. Enjoy the view from the top. Using your creative side to close a deal. 1. Listen carefully and observe. 2. What's the icing on the cake? Chapter 9. How to Fail Smarter. Corfu, Greece, July 7th, 2016. I had my tux on and I thought it looked great. Bright blue was the right choice. I did a quick check to make sure nothing was stuck in my teeth and wiped the sweat from my brow. Greece in July equals hot. Everything was in order, and in a few minutes I would board the pirate ship, yes, I said pirate ship, that would take me to an ancient church on a tiny island where I would marry Amelia in front of all our friends and family, and the world, eventually, as Bravo was filming it. Planning a wedding for 150 people on a Greek island was not without its challenges. So when my phone started ringing incessantly, I braced myself for a wedding-related disaster. It could have been anything. The priest was kidnapped. The church had blown up. The extreme heat had caused the guest to break out into a brawl. Or we had offended the god Poseidon and he had hurled our wedding cake into the Ionian Sea. I would have preferred it if any of the above had happened. At least it would have made a really good story, rather than what I was about to face. Let's rewind the story a bit to my history with Gemma Markelson. New York City, June 15th, 2016. I had been working with Gemma for 4 years. I had been using all the 3 F's of follow-up, I can promise you. I'd show her an apartment, she'd fall in love, get close to buying it, change her mind, and decide to just keep renting. She was a very loyal client, so I never even thought about giving up on her, but she was very picky, and she changed her mind a lot. 1 month, she would only want to see apartments with floor-to-ceiling windows and views of the Hudson River. The next month, she wanted the same thing, but swap out the Hudson River view with the Empire State Building. Then came the infatuation with open kitchens, followed by a flirtation with the Flatiron Loft. There was also the brief phase of only ground floor units because it will be easier for my band to practice. What? I had no idea she was in a band. This back and forth with Gemma had been going on and off for a long time. Then, in 2016, about a month before I was going to Greece to get married to the love of my life, I got a great listing on 12th Street. I knew I had the perfect buyer for it. Gemma. I called her the second I knew I had the listing. She was excited to hear about the exposed brick, the high ceilings, the big master bedroom with an ensuite bathroom, and the open layout. It didn't have a view of either a river or a landmark building, but it was well-priced and had a huge home office that she could convert to a screening room or a recording studio. When she walked through the door, I noticed that she blushed and smiled. This had never happened before. It was perfect. Gemma had found her home. I'd planned to list the apartment for $5 million, but hadn't even put it on the market yet, so I had to make a deal between Gemma and the seller. Enter Gemma's mother. Gemma found an apartment! Great! Let's offer $4 million cash, closing anytime. Wonderful. Actually, not wonderful. At this point in the deal, the part where the apartment isn't on the market yet, every seller says the exact same thing. They want to offer what? The apartment isn't even on the market yet. And really, that offer is so low, it's insulting. You haven't even done any work at all. Let's put it on the market and sit back while countless above-asking offers roll in. Find me a Russian billionaire. To which the buyer always responds, why would I increase my offer? It's not even on the market yet. Why would I negotiate against myself? Screw that guy. Tell him to take it or leave it. Good luck finding a Russian billionaire to overpay. And I'm in the middle, like a little kid stuck between mom and dad, trying to decide the best way to get them to see eye to eye. Sirhan's secret number 19. Salespeople often find themselves in the middle of situations that feel impossible. But there's always a solution. Every deal is a deal if you can figure out how to bridge the gap. My seller and buyer were $1 million apart, which may seem like a lot, but to me, it was just a gap I needed to close. I've learned that this is a crucial moment in every sale. It's in the messy middle, full-on stage three, fear. This is where most deals are usually made or lost. The truth was, based on the condition of the apartment and the most recent comparable sales, $5 million was too high and $4 million was too low. But who cares about facts when you're an oversensitive buyer or seller anyway, right? This meant I had to find a mutually agreeable number for both clients. I had to bridge the gap or risk all of us tumbling into the pit of dead deals. I went to work convincing each party they should make an effort to see if we could reach an agreement. My number one rule at the beginning of any negotiation is to always counter. Clients so often feel there is no point in doing so. They'll say, "We're too far apart, there's no point." But I've seen time and time again how coaxing two parties to make counters can result in a mutually beneficial transaction where both sides feel they got a good deal, and the broker is happy because he got the sale done. But bridging the gap isn't as simple as coming down or coming up in price. You have to play to the fears. Remember how we discussed having walls, and the wall being our motivation to succeed? Buyers and sellers have the same thing. The seller's biggest wall is a future in which they have not sold. The buyer's biggest wall is a future in which they have not bought. Seems simple, right? I play to those fears in every negotiation. With my seller on 12th Street, I reminded him that the risk of not countering was going on the market and not selling at all. Was not selling at all worth not even engaging with this excited early buyer? The seller listened to my argument and agreed to reduce the price by $250,000 for a quick sale. Yes. I reminded my buyer this was an off-market deal. She was getting in early and, P.S., her daughter had been searching for an apartment for 4 years. Wouldn't she like to see her happily settled? She agreed to come up $250,000 for a quick sale. Just like that, the million-mile distance was slashed in half. I know I'm talking about big numbers here, but what you should understand is that I'm making the gap relative. Whether you're trying to close a $1 million gap or a $10 one, break it down. I basically asked each side to come up, relatively speaking, $2.50. That doesn't sound nearly as bad as bridging a $1 million gap, now does it? We were getting somewhere, Except, we weren't there yet. No one wanted to budge an inch further, and no one was ready to agree to the deal either. The seller was thinking, I just came down $250,000 on a place that's not even on the market yet. While the buyer was thinking, you guessed it, I just went up $250,000 on a place